Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. It's time to learn and improve your American English skills and learn about our world at the same time. Today we will talk about something that probably affects you or someone in your family, the high cost of getting an education. It is a problem in the United States and around the world. Pete Mustoe and Jill Robbins have the latest for us.
Thousands of protesters marched through London on Wednesday to express anger about the rising cost of higher education. The UK joins a growing list of countries that saw angry crowds of students taking to the streets over the past year. South Africa and Chile both had large protests of the cost of higher education in the last few months. A plan to cut government money that supports full-time university students is the reason for the London protests. This money, called maintenance grants, helps full-time higher education students with the cost of living. Students do not have to pay the money back to the government. British Member of Parliament George Osborne announced in June that maintenance grants would no longer be available. Osborne said that starting in 2016, the government will offer maintenance loans instead. These loans will need to be paid back. Cuts to supports for students will affect low- and middle-income students the most, critics say.
The problem of higher education costs for poorer people was also at the center of the South African demonstrations. The University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg announced that it would increase fees by 10.5% in 2016. Student protests then caused the university to stop all activity on October 14th. Demonstrations spread to several other universities across the country, as well as outside Parliament. The protests quickly became the largest in the country since the end of apartheid in 1994. Apartheid was the social system in South Africa that began in 1948. During the period of apartheid, black people and people of other races did not have the same rights as white people. South African President Jacob Zuma declared on October 23rd there would be no increase to university fees. However, the protests still have not ended. Income inequality and racism are also issues protesters want the government to recognize. The University of Witwatersrand recently released a study of these issues. The results of that study show 60% of the country's black African workers live in poverty.
Chile's protests throughout this year are part of a longer struggle as well. The Confederation of Chilean Student Federations, or CONFECH, is an organization that fights for change to the country's education system. CONFECH began organizing university students in 2011. Their goal was to get the government to improve the public education system. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet's promises to change the education system helped her win the 2013 election. Bachelet signed a bill on Monday giving control of the entire public education system to the central government. This bill would share resources in all schools equally. But many of the protesters say the president has not done enough. Protesters include in their demands free university education for all people. Bachelet has promised free university education for 70% of the country's poorest people. Demonstrations continue, though, as it is not clear how the country will pay for free higher education.
An important quality uniting these protests around the world is the use of social media. The National Campaign Against Fees and Cuts, or NCAFC, is a London-based organization that fights tuition fees and education cuts. NCAFC created the hashtag GrantsNotDebt to spread information about Wednesday's protests over the internet. Organizers in South Africa used the hashtag FeesMustFall. Chilean protesters used Twitter and Facebook to share photos and stories of what is happening in the streets. Violence has also been present at some of the protests. South African police used water cannon and stun grenades on protesters in the city of Pretoria. A property owner shot and killed two young men in the Chilean city of Valparaiso in May. The young men were hanging a sign on the side of the property owner's building.
Groups in all three countries continue working to make education cheaper and easier to access. The NCAFC has plans for another march on November 17th. British Labour Party member John McDonnell voiced his concerns at the march on Wednesday. "Education is a gift from one generation to another," he told marchers. "It is not a commodity to be bought or sold." Ralph Matheka studies politics in South Africa. He told VOA that these protests could mean major changes in the African National Congress, or ANC. The ANC will have local elections next year. Matheka believes that the protests show a change in the way people will vote. "What we have seen is actually the growing power of the middle class in South Africa," Matheka said. "And the question is, how far is this going to go?" The cost of higher education is a major issue in the United States as well. The Institute for College Access and Success is an organization that studies the cost of education. The organization released a report on Tuesday about debt from student loans in the U.S. The report shows that 69% of higher education students used loans to pay for school in 2014. The average loan debt among those students is $28,950. Next week, we will look at ways some students avoid debt and find cheaper ways to get an education. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Thank you.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. The world's English continues to improve, says a newly released study. The report, called the EF English Proficiency Index, is a yearly report card on the English level of adults in 70 countries. Sweden leads the world, while Libya is last.
It is no surprise that Sweden, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Norway take the top four places. These countries have excellent public education systems and native languages that are structurally similar to English. France is the exception in Western Europe. Its English proficiency is much lower than its neighbors. The report says France's poor performance could be due to a cultural aversion to English. Turkey has the lowest English proficiency in Europe. The report says Turkey's emphasis on grammar and memorization discourages students.
In Asia, China has slipped 10 places since last year. Part of this drop is because the survey added 3 countries. The other reason is that 7 Latin American countries showed more improvement than China. Min Chun is EF's Director of Research and Academic Partnerships. He says China has made great progress over the past 10 years, and the overall trend is still positive. But he says China will have to change the way it teaches English if it wants to reach a higher level. Singapore, Malaysia, and India have the highest proficiency in the region.
English fever continues in South Korea, where people spend more money on English education than any other place in the world. But South Korea's average English level is not improving. Vietnam has improved slightly since last year. Thailand and Cambodia remain at very low proficiency, despite their strong tourism industries. Argentina is the first and only Latin American country to rank as high proficiency on the survey. Brazil has shown some improvement, but it still does not have enough competent English speakers in its workforce, the report says.
English ability is going down in the Middle East and North Africa. The United Arab Emirates, with its large multinational workforce, ranks better than its neighbors. However, it still has low proficiency. Education has suffered because of violence and instability in Iraq, Yemen, and Libya, where English levels are very low. The Gulf kingdoms of Qatar, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia have very low English proficiency despite their wealth. The EF English Proficiency Index is based on data from people who took an EF online English test in 2014. It is called the FSET, and you can take it online for free. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The battle between the North and the South spread in the summer of 1861. Union soldiers fought pro-Southern rioters in the streets of Baltimore and St. Louis. A Confederate supporter shot and killed a young officer from the North. Untrained soldiers from both sides fought in the mountains of western Virginia. So far, though, the fighting had not claimed many lives. But very soon, the battle would become fierce. This week in our series, Frank Oliver and Jack Weitzel continue the story of the American Civil War.
The old general who commanded the Union forces, Winfield Scott, did not want to rush his men into battle. Scott believed it would be a long war. He planned to spend the first year of it getting ready to fight. He had an army of thousands of men, and it would get much larger in coming months. But this army was not trained. His soldiers were civilians who knew nothing about fighting a war. General Scott needed time to make soldiers of these men. He also needed time to organize a supply system to get to his forces the guns, bullets, food, and clothing they would need. Without supplies, his army could not fight very long. There were many in the North, however, who thought Scott was too careful. It was true, they said, that Union forces were untrained, but so were those of the South. And the Confederacy's supply problems were even greater than those of the Union. The South had much less industry and fewer railroads. It could not produce as much military equipment, and it could not transport supplies as easily as the North could. In the early months of the war, Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, did not even have guns enough for the men in his army. Those who demanded immediate action expected a short war. They said Scott should take the army and march to Richmond. They were sure that if Union forces seized the Confederate capital, the Southern Rebellion would end. Northern newspapers took up the cry, "On to Richmond." Political leaders began pressing for a quick Northern victory. Public pressure forced the army to act. For more than a month, General Irvin McDowell had been building a Union army in Northern Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington. He had more than 30,000 men at bases in Arlington and Alexandria. Late in June, McDowell received orders. March against the Confederate Army of General Pierre Beauregard. Beauregard had 20,000 soldiers at Manassas Junction, a railroad village in Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. McDowell planned to move on Manassas Junction July 9th, but was delayed for more than a week. He planned the attack carefully. McDowell was worried that another large Confederate force west of Manassas Junction might join Beauregard's army. This force, led by General Joe Johnston, was in the Shenandoah Valley near Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Across from Harper's Ferry in Maryland was a Union army almost twice the size of Johnston's. It was ordered to put pressure on Johnston's force to prevent it from helping Beauregard. General Beauregard received early warning from Confederate spies that McDowell would attack. Much of his information came from a woman, Mrs. Rose O'Neill Greenhow. Mrs. Greenhow, a widow, was an important woman in Washington. She knew almost all the top government officials, and she had friends in almost every department of the government. The beautiful Mrs. Greenhow also had some very special friends. One was Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts. He was chairman of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs. Another special friend was Thomas Jordan, a Confederate colonel in Beauregard's army. Jordan asked Mrs. Greenhouse soon after the war started to be a spy for the South. She agreed and sent much valuable information about Union military plans. Early in July, she sent word to Beauregard that he would be attacked soon. She also sent a map used by the Senate Military Affairs Committee showing how the Union Army would reach Manassas Junction. Then, on the morning of July 16th, Mrs. Greenhow wrote a 9-word message. She gave it to a man to carry to Beauregard. The Confederate general received it that evening. It said, "Order given for McDowell to march upon Manassas tonight." Beauregard sent a telegram to Richmond. He told the Confederate government that McDowell was on the way. He asked that Johnston's 10,000-man force in the Shenandoah Valley join him for battle. He was told to expect Johnston's help. But Johnston's army was threatened by a large Union force that entered Virginia from Maryland. Led by General Robert Patterson, the Union troops moved toward the smaller Confederate force. They were not really interested in fighting Johnston, but they did want to prevent him from reaching Beauregard. Johnston knew he could not defeat Patterson, so he decided to trick him. While most of his army withdrew and prepared to join Beauregard, Johnston sent a small force to attack Patterson's army. Patterson believed Johnston was attacking with all his troops. He stopped moving forward and prepared to defend against what seemed to be a strong Confederate attack. By the time the trick was discovered, Johnston and most of his troops were at Manassas. General McDowell's huge Union army left Arlington on the afternoon of July 16th. It was a hot day and the road was dusty. The march was not well organized, and the men traveled slowly. They stopped at every stream to drink and wash the dust from their faces. Some of the soldiers left the road to pick fruits and berries from bushes along the way. To some of those who watched this army pass, the lines of soldiers in bright clothes looked like a long circus parade. Most of these men had not been soldiers long. Their bodies were soft and they tired quickly. It took them 4 days to travel the 45 kilometers to Centerville, the final town before Bull Run. The battle would start the next morning, Sunday, July 21st.
The road from Washington was crowded early Sunday morning with horses and wagons bringing people to watch the great battle. Hundreds of men and women watched the fight from a hill near Centerville. Below them was Bull Run. But the battleground was covered so thickly with trees that the crowds saw little of the fighting. They could, however, see the smoke of battle, and they could hear the sounds of shots and exploding shells. From time to time, Union officers would ride up the hill to report what a great victory their troops were winning.
In the first few hours of the battle, Union forces were winning.
McDowell had moved most of his men to the left side of Beauregard's army. They attacked with artillery and pushed the Confederate forces back. It seemed that the Confederate defense would break. Some of the Southern soldiers began to run, but others stood and fought. One Confederate officer, trying to prevent his troops from moving back, pointed to a group led by General T.J. Jackson of Virginia. "Look," he shouted, "there is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Fight like the Virginians." The Confederate troops refused to break. The fighting was fierce. The air was full of flying bullets. A newsman wrote that the whole valley was boiling with dust and smoke. A Confederate soldier told his friend, "Them Yankees are just marching up and being shot to hell." Neither side would give up. Then a large group of Johnston's troops arrived by train and joined in the fight. Suddenly, Union soldiers stopped fighting and began pulling back. General McDowell and his officers tried to stop the retreat, but failed. Their men wanted no more fighting.
The fleeing Union soldiers threw down their guns and equipment, thinking only of escape. Many did not stop until they reached Washington. It was a bitter defeat, but it made the North recognize the need for a real army, one trained and equipped for war. President Abraham Lincoln gave the job of building such an army to General George McClellan.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Frank Oliver and Jack Weitzel. Our series can be found online with transcripts, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our programs at twitter.com/voalearnenglish. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.